Welcome back to Real Tech Talk, people, episode number 45. Now, this company is apropos to what's happening today, Pronto Housing, my girl Christine. How do you make efficiencies in the affordable housing market? We know that there's a massive demand. We know that there isn't enough supply. And even that supply, we're not getting bodies into those places fast enough. Well, she has come up with the solution. So sit down. Pay attention, listen to my girl, Christine, when we talk about Pronto Housing.
That's why we're here, bro. This is Real Tech Talk, boom shakalaka. So who the hell are you, bro? You know, what are you into? What do you do?
Yo, you can keep it real here. Tell me about these real estate players.
Eric Brody is the managing principal of CEMVC LLC. All opinions expressed by Eric and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of CEMVC LLC. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of CEMVC LLC may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Welcome back, people. Real Tech Talk, episode number 45. And today, as you know, we have a housing crisis in major cities of affordability. And finally, I get to bring you someone that saw that problem and then started attacking, my homegirl, Christine of Pronto Housing. Thank you for taking the time to come see us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let me tell you a little bit about like how I like the format. We want to know first, like, who are you? Why did you get into real estate, or how do you know about real estate tech? And then tell me, and by the way, it's going to be like a 9-part question, affordable housing, and then even doper than that, you do an opco, propco setup, so we could get into that also. So let's start with, so like, who are you? Where are you from? Why are you in real estate and tech?
I am from the Bay Area originally, so.
Oh, a San Franner.
Yes, well, little south of there, a little warmer, Palo Alto. But I did spend some time in San Francisco before B school and then before moving to New York, where I am rooted and probably going to be for life.
Amazing. So, now, can I just ask this as a side note? You know, you are young. Was Silicon Valley and Palo there when you were growing up? Like, was that just an influence around you?
Yes. So I started my career in commercial banking in Palo Alto. So we had customers like Palantir, Facebook, Google, right? Those were our
For the banking services.
Yeah. Yeah. So those were.
Did you know Silicon Valley Bank?
Yes.
Is that a competitor?
Yes, they were. And everyone was in tech, and being in finance, everyone was like, you're in finance.
You were definitely the black sheep of the area, of course.
My family was in real estate, so I grew up around real estate, and I sort of naturally gravitated towards real estate. So I started.
What type of real estate were they in? Were they multifamily owners, developers? What was their space?
All triple net leased tech focused office. Yeah, so all in the office space.
So they were acquiring it. They weren't developing that product.
My dad was a investor developer, company called Menlo Equities Properties.
Side note, can I ask you just a question? And I'm sorry, this is like my favorite question. Everyone says if like you grew up on that, like you went to the sites and like you always knew you wanted to be in it. And you know, I grew up, my father was an architect and I'd go to job sites and I'd play with the guard dogs and I'd throw things at the wall, right? I wasn't like, oh, look at the architectural significance of this asset. Do you have the same experience or you're like, no, my greatest influence was walking the job sites when I was younger with my father?
I will say that my family is much more financially oriented than most families. Like, if the S&P moves 5 basis points, my mom like texts me. And growing up, my dad did take me to sites, but it was more about one with suburban tech office. I was like, so much parking lot, such boring architecture. That was not something I was interested in pursuing.
Okay. So you got into the finance game. So you started in finance, which I always find like fascinating, people's journey. And in the tech that we have found so far, it's coming from all different angles. So you started with finance. Boom.
Yes. And I actually always said I'm not going to do tech because it's very chaotic. I remember a friend worked at Palantir and I went to their office and the desks were like everywhere, really disorganized. And I was like, this place is crazy. Just like the physical organization of the office is madness. And people are wearing like pajamas and sneakers because they're tech people. And this is so weird. And now I look at my office at Pronto and I'm like, there's like snacks in the windowsill. And it's just
But you're not wearing sweatpants.
I'm not. So yeah, you win some, you lose some. But it's
so
just,
where did it go from finance though? So you're in the finance game, then what?
So I spent most of my career in finance. I was on the lending side. I went to business school at Kellogg at Northwestern. I moved to New York and worked at RXR Realty in their development asset management group. So multifamily.
And that's high density. That's large. That's real urban development.
Yes. And they have a regional thesis of basically housing in New York should be not just New York City. They're the master developer of New Rochelle. Mm-hmm. They have stuff in White Plains and other parts around New York.
Okay.
So then I went to a small...
How long were you there?
I was there for about 2 years. Mm-hmm. Then I went to Megalith Capital, which is a small developer.
Yeah.
And
but that's boots on the ground now. I know Megalith.
Yeah.
They were doing, you know, 50-unit multifamily, right? Something
yes,
like that?
Exactly. So both of those roles, I had properties that I was overseeing from an asset management perspective.
Oh, so you got out of finance now. Now you are responsible for executing that sort of as the developer. But since they have multiple developments, you had a responsibility for one.
Definitely still on the finance side. So asset management, so the financing of those buildings, working with the property manager on the lease up and the financial implications that come with that.
Now the picture is becoming clear because I know what Pronto does, but keep going.
Both, all of those buildings had an affordable housing component.
Right. So you were in the 421A mix, right?
Exactly.
Affordable New York program.
Yes. And the New Rochelle also has some affordable requirements as well, as do a lot of cities across mm-hmm. the country, right? And as an asset manager, I was like, this is a small percentage of the units, and yet it is taking so much time. Right. I'm meeting with a marketing agent, someone who focuses on affordable housing every week. I know that there's massive demand, and yet those units from week to week are just not being leased. And I'm like,
so let's break it down because we don't know if the audience completely understands sort of the affordable New York, although it's probably across the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in New York, in New York City, is it the state or the city that's running that program? And what office is it?
Yeah, so 421A is specifically New York City,
and it's HPD, right?
We might need to edit that. I'll go verify that.
Whatever. It's all good. So it's HPD, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we have all these regulations around it, right? Because we want it to be fair, we want it to be equitable, right? And there's a process, right? And what is that process? And why is it like it's so archaic? And I agree with you. I just finished the development in Greenpoint, and in order to get these affordable units rented when you knew there was all this demand, it's brain damage. So what is that process, or what was the nightmare that you went through?
Yeah. So to qualify people for affordable housing is a really detailed process to verify their income, assets, and in New York and sometimes in other markets, you have something called preference groups. So basically other characteristics that say that household can live in that specific unit. So,
and by the way, by way of example, that's like all your tax forms, your W-2s, your 1099s, right? Because they want to qualify you that you fit within that revenue bracket or that income bracket to then qualify for that unit, right?
Yes. I would add that in affordable housing, a lot of income sources that you wouldn't think of as, oh, that's income, do count. So, for example, there is this concept of gift income. So let's say my adult child gives me $50 a month for something that is not food, but just for general living expenses. I would annualize that and count that in the annual income for that household.
And it's a qualification of AMI, right? So it's like
the area median income.
Got you. Okay.
Another,
what's is fascinating because you would also assume, you know, like anyone, do they have that data readily available in order to fill out this form?
Yes. And then there's also, so like another example is self-employment. A lot of people, they're like, oh, I watch my neighbor's kid, you know, every Friday. They don't consider themselves self-employed, you know, but they do get paid for that. So they are self-employed for affordable housing. But, and to your point, if you were to ask them for documentation, like put together a P&L for you're babysitting once a week. They're like, what?
Right. So now on the consumer side, it's difficult. What about on the bureaucratic side?
So there is the regulatory agency side, but I'm going to take a step kind of in between, which is the property team side. So on the property side, when you think about who is doing this work, there's generally two camps of people. There are people who are affordable housing compliance experts, and then there are property managers that got tasked with this. Both of those groups are not super process oriented. They're not thinking about, okay, here's my output of this form package, and what steps am I taking to get there? Which steps can I eliminate so that I can get to this output faster, right?
They're right. Like, so what's the end goal, though, just so we can back up, right? So you've got, as you stated, you've got the developer developing that asset, and they have teams. They have the attorneys that are going to get them approved, right? Mm-hmm. And then they have to now have a regulatory body, like you're saying, which usually is a third party, right?
Yeah. So the regulatory agreement between the property and that regulatory agency dictates the requirements of compliance. So usually it's, okay, you need to income qualify residents, and then there might be annual reporting. A lot of times you have to income qualify residents every single year. Oh, wow. And then also that regulatory agency is providing whatever that subsidy is. So for 421A, that's a real estate tax abatement, but it could also be, other examples are a density bonus or vouchers where you have the income line subsidized. Mm-hmm. So
so what do we have? We got lawyers for the developer. We got the developer. We have the management company. You have that third party compliance / marketing company. And you have the government that is supposed to be now implementing these programs.
Yes. One other potential player for LIHTC specifically, which is low-income housing tax credits, one of the largest federal types of subsidy for affordable housing. You also have a syndicator, which is someone who takes those tax credits, sells them so that the developer gets equity to invest in the property. And then they basically act as a third-party asset manager.
So you have six parties, and we're probably missing some. Mm-hmm. And and you were in that space as you were an asset manager at Megalith, and you're like, there's something wrong here?
I'm like, why is this building taking so long to lease when we had 40,000 people apply?
Right. Yep. Let's just back up. 50 units, 30% affordable, 15 units, 40,000 people applying for 15 units, right? And it's like the demand is there. This should have been like a millisecond and done. And yet our experience as principal developers, yours as an asset manager, mine as a developer, is this process is like really slow. And you're like, how could it be that all these parties are making it more difficult when you want to get bodies into these units? And it's such a need.
100%.
And is that now the kernel of Pronto?
Yes, definitely. So Pronto's whole purpose is to make it fast, easy, efficient for both property teams and on the resident side to qualify people for affordable housing, both for that initial lease up and that annual compliance process.
Okay, amazing. What tech is that?
You can think of Pronto like TurboTax for affordable housing. So the resident receives an email, a text message, they could get in through a website, somehow they get into the Pronto platform. They walk through an iterative questionnaire. And one thing that's really critical here is that it is configurable for any affordable housing program. So Pronto is not just the solution for HUD or LIHTC or New York.
It's not limited geographically.
No, not at all. Or by program. So we have customers who focus on affordable, but we also have customers that focus on market rate and got stuck with some affordable units because of their zoning.
Correct.
And then on the property team side, it's automating and streamlining that workflow. So creating that form package output and then also capturing all of those resident communications.
So it's a workflow, though. It's a workflow software. It's not as if you're creating the market for it. It's not as if you are, you know, saying getting the 40,000 people to be onboarded. It is a workflow that is, I guess, like you said, iterative. And the user experience is just a lot simpler than all these documents that are being submitted to you where we had the seven parties all filling out different documents.
Yes.
And what have you found out so far? So, Albert, so like, boom, you're like, it's a workflow. Is it 100% automated yet? Or is it like pieces of that workflow are now automated and there's still a service end to it?
We are still a tool for the property team. So it's definitely not 100% automated. You need someone to use the tool for it to, you know, for that output to happen.
Yeah, I think that like, real estate and technology, you know, they were selling each other things that weren't true, which is why I like defining that, meaning it'll be disrupt and 100% automated, click a button, it's done. And the reality is, no, it's that here's a process that is from A to Z, and we know it's broken. But if we can create workflows that create efficiencies of 10%, 12%, we're just making you more efficient, and that's a huge value.
Yes, and there are financial implications there, right? You have, if you're leasing up 5 times faster with Pronto, you can refinance your construction loan, you can reduce your net operating loss on the stabilized assets. Whenever you have turnover, you're filling those units faster, and you can reduce the staffing that is taking on this task of annual compliance.
Which is another, I think, something that's really like intelligent from, you know, this discussion, which is real estate is Machiavellian, right? Like, what is the end result? And you're right. Right? If I had a building, 80 units, we had 24 affordable units, we had to wait until, like, we were giving assumptions as what we perceived to the lender what the NOI would be in order to refinance it. But you know how much better and faster and better terms I would have had if it actually was rented and they were paying?
Yeah.
Right? Like, that is a cold, hard fact. And I always look at tech when it's obvious to me that it's a solution. Like, that's obvious, you know? Like, it's obvious Pronto, if what we're stating, and you can tell us now, like, what is actually happening with Pronto, but like, it's obvious that that is going to help. Like,
yeah,
it speeds up the process. If that process now, and the paperwork is perfect to HPD or whomever, you know, I know I keep saying that because I'm a New Yorker, but like, whatever organization that is, and it's 100% perfect, now you can just hammer them to hurry up, right? You can't deal with the government or push them. But like, if every document was perfect and filled out the way that they want to see it, I mean,
yeah,
we talk about it all the time with the way expediters file, the way offering plans are filed. The better the format and the cleaner it is, the faster it goes.
Exactly.
So how big is the Pronto team? Where are you guys mostly located? And tell us just a little bit about, you know, what you're seeing today as you've now entered the marketplace, right? You're actually operating in this, in where are you operating?
Yeah. So we were founded in 2020, so it's been about 4 years. We have 15 full-time staff members, primarily in New York, where mm-hmm. we're based. We also have contract engineers in Guadalajara, Mexico. And
I heard South Americans, the engineers are like on fire right now.
Yeah.
I know a bunch of them. My homeboys that are up here went to the University of Chicago. Just whatever. Side note, amazing. They're doing amazing software engineering.
So about half our team is focused on the tech side, and that is the bulk of our customers. So we have 30 customers, about 30,000 units. We're at over $1 million of ARR, and we are in 18 states today and growing. So as I mentioned before, we're configurable for any affordable housing program. So mm-hmm. we just follow our customers.
So tell me a little bit just about the journey, because I'm like a layperson. Like, all right, I'm a developer and I'm like, I got to lease this up. Who's your customer? Is it that principal developer, or is it like in New York, we have these third party companies that are supposed to now, you know, sort of do that and then market and fill for you? Or is that the customer? Like, who, and then like, how does it work for them from like the super, super basic way of looking at it?
Yeah. So our end user is always the property manager. Our customer is a little more nuanced because it depends on the relationship between that owner, investor, and their manager.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them go to their managers and say, hey, I want you to use Pronto. And our contract is directly with that owner who's looking to roll it out across their portfolio, potentially across multiple property managers. We also work directly with property managers where it's the inverse of that, right? They're like, okay, we want to use Pronto across our portfolios, and we're working with many different owners.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also work directly with compliance consultants and with nonprofits who might be managers or owners themselves.
So, but the software itself, is it the consumer, the potential renter, is filling out the application appropriately, like mm-hmm. you said, where it's intuitive and makes the most sense. Now that manager is getting qualified renters or potential renters, and then they're submitting that then to the city or state organization for their approval?
Yes, exactly.
And instead of that being all paperwork, fax, PDF, this is like a perfect package.
Yes. And I would add that for the most part, when we start working with customers, we are replacing a quite manual process. A lot of times if you ask your property manager, like, hey, what compliance software do you use? They'll say, oh, I use Yardi, I use RealPage, I use MRI, whatever it is. But then you push them a little bit more and you're like, okay, so do your residents have to come in person to submit documentation? 90% of the time, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Of course, some of them are doing it on email.
Right.
But for the most part, it's in person. And then you say, okay, about the form package, are you filling out those forms by hand? Either you're manually entering PDFs or you're literally printing them and then filling out things by hand. And yeah, 99% of the time.
I think that's a great point also. You know, people think it's like this revolution, right? You're like, no, people are still, you know, laggard and they're doing things in a way that's just inefficient. And at least now, not only is it efficient, you probably have a database where it's perfectly columned as to what the responses to that information is. And it's easily now, you know, readable and usable and put into a format that you can now, you know, effectively get information from if there's any quick question or whatever it is. It's all there. Instead of you flipping through paperwork or looking for the scan of the PDF of the info, like, it's wild.
Yeah, 100%. There's repercussions, not just at the property level, but a lot of times these auditors, when you ask them, how do you get this information? They say, we get scanned, handwritten documents that we manually enter into Excel. And you're just like, wow.
So it must be
so much room for improvement.
Are there just so many customers then? I mean, like, maybe you haven't started really marketing and are really out there, but it sounds to me that, you know, everyone, it's a compliance software that's working for this. Like, why wouldn't you do it? Why wouldn't you layer that in? Right. So have you expanded just exponentially? Or is the demand ridiculous?
Yeah. So last year we grew 21x year over year. And we have grown all organically so far, all wow. Just warm introductions from customers, people we know in the affordable housing space, our investors. We've done zero marketing.
Well, that ends today.
And in terms of business development, it's really me and Casey, who is my co-founder and our COO.
Well, you're about to get inundated. Inundated because we know who's watching this show, so hit her up. That is really, really like an obvious to me. So, but give me then, let's say, and I'm not saying it's going to happen, you own the American affordable market, right? Or I don't even know, you own 50% of it. What's the vision? Like, what happens after that?
Yeah. So there are two paths. One is that we are an add-on solution for a property management software. So like I said, the property management software is the sort of, you know, big giants in the room. Mm-hmm. They all have an affordable module, but we know that it still creates a very manual process.
Yeah, they would need a whole team and they would have to learn the nuance of the legislation. Like, I'm sorry. It's just, it's its own company.
So there's that. And then the other piece is that we have a ton of ideas about other areas in affordable housing that need to be disrupted. So
I have a feeling you're going to be on Capitol Hill one day, right? Because just sidebar.
Oh, I don't know if I have the patience for that.
Yeah, well, it might happen. You'll be, you know, because like a sidebar. We talk about this all the time. It's like, who owns the data? And the reason that is then you can get learning modules on it and like who can then create sort of AI on the data in order to create insights. And it's like, if you own the affordable data in this country, right? It's like, then you become the authority as to more people coming into the programs, out of the programs, how American life is. Like, you start to, you know, we always think about it now as like, who has the specific data? It's like, you would have the specific data.
Yes. Right?
And it'd be across the country, not a state, not a city, not a geographic region, the entire country.
Yeah. I think some questions that we hope over time that we're able to answer is a lot of times you hear this statistic about the number of affordable units that we need or the number of housing units we need to solve the affordable housing crisis. And it's usually somewhere between 3 and 7 million units that we are short.
Mm. But you don't know where it's coming from, right?
Well, there are studies that break it down by state and sometimes in more granular detail. But looking at, okay, we know that the very lowest income earners, so those earning 30% AMI or less, that's right. The greatest need. Mm. But when you get above that, the data is not as clear. And particularly, a lot of times people talk about the missing middle, which is usually around 80% of area median income. But we know from watching those lease-ups that if you have above 80% AMI, so 421A in New York.
At 130.
Exactly. Those units are very hard to fill. And there's two reasons for that. One is that the discount to market rate is just a little bit.
Right.
So would it help those households to pay less in rent? Yes. That means they could feed their kids healthier food.
Or whatever it is. Yes. Right. Saving money. Yeah. Correct.
Exactly. But their tolerance for a not customer-friendly process is very low, right?
They're used to... So if you can reduce that friction, right, and get those units filled because there's still a massive need, like it's huge.
Yes, exactly. So I think that having the data around what is that gap in the market in terms of where, like how much do you have to discount it from the market rate where that AMI is willing to go through the process. That's kind of an interesting data point where you can then meet the need of that particular income level in the community. And then also thinking about capital allocation, right? So how can you best allocate capital to create affordable housing that meets the biggest needs of those communities?
Yeah, you would be the one informing them, right? You would be informing policy or you'd be informing a municipality, right? Yeah. I mean, which is just tremendous. So let me ask you a question. What is the solution in New York to the affordable housing crisis?
Bam.
Wow.
Got them.
So there's not going to be one solution. I would say definitely just supply. We need more housing.
Right? I just wanted to hear you say that. It just makes me feel like, and it's not like it's happening, right? Isn't it really odd in New York? Like, what's your opinion on that? The legislation is like, no. And yet you're like, I have the data. It's like, there's so much demand. Like, we are at the forefront of it. Like,
yeah. I mean, I don't think it's controversial to have basic economics, right? Supply and demand. There is a lot of demand. We need more supply. The other piece of it is when you think about, like, what is affordable housing? It is housing where the rent is restricted. That means your income for a building is lower. So how do you make that financially viable? You have to subsidize it in some other way, right? So that could be reducing your operating expenses, which would be through real estate taxes or a very hot button issue. What if, from a policy perspective, somehow there was a subsidy on insurance costs for affordable housing? Right now, insurance is actually much more expensive for affordable housing, which is terrible. Or you need to increase that revenue line so that you get to an NOI that is competitive with a market rate property, because there is a cost of capital. And if someone is choosing an affordable housing unit versus a market rate unit, I'm sure some people will do it out of the good of their heart, and that is wonderful. But from a market perspective, it has to be financially commensurate.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. I truly appreciate like that opinion of it, right? Because it's not coming from a biased, oh, I'm a for-profit developer. You're like, no, like my game is the affordability and creating efficiencies in that space to put bodies into these units that are required. And I'm telling you, we don't have enough.
I want a solution that moves the market. It's not just, okay, we got philanthropic capital for this one building. That's great, but it's not... You know, that affects those 200 people, and that is wonderful, but it's not a market-moving solution, in my opinion.
I agree. Yeah. So are you seeing and are you now, like, at the forefront of policy? Like, do you track that information? Like, do you know if any, like, is the discussion occurring?
Yes. I would say that affordability is much more prevalent in terms of being part of the policy conversation across the country than it was 5 years ago, and certainly 10 years ago. And the reason for that, and this is not a nice thing to say, but most people would agree that the reason for that is because the housing affordability crisis has gotten bad enough that it affects middle-class white people.
Mm. And you're saying that's a voter base, and they're starting to pay attention as a result. And in this country, that's a powerful group of people.
And it's a group of people that people listen to. Mm. That's not nice, but the fact is people
listen,
of
I
color.
I think it's important to look at the lens of reality. Like, we have to stop. We have to, like, be able to communicate with each other without thinking that every time we say something, we're offending. So it's all good by me.
Yeah. And the reality is that people of color have had a very serious housing affordability crisis for much longer, and it wasn't as big of a part of the conversation. We have for a long time had the federal program. So we've had Section 8, low-income housing tax credits, all the HUD programs. But what is changing is all of the local programs. So, for example, in LA, Mayor Bass issued this executive directive where buildings that are 100% affordable have an expedited approval process for their permit, their building permits.
So they're taking where the levers are within each sort of legislative body and trying to assist somehow.
Yes. And the result is that last year, about three times as many affordable units were approved as the prior 3 years.
And you know what, if we take that out, which I think is pretty fascinating to like economics for a developer, it's like if you knew your approval would be in 1 month, in 6 weeks with that approval, you'd have you know, excavation and you would already start you getting into the ground with your foundation, and then it was really on you to build that bad boy, let's say in 12 months, and now you've got a new development up in 14 months, I'm taking less interest, I don't have to worry as much as to what my soft costs will be. Like we're hauling ass, right? And then we're filling it up, which changes the entire economics, because as we're talking about all the time today, with the raise in interest rates, it's like 30 to 40% of the total cost of the project, of just the hard cost, would be the finance cost. Like, it's insane.
Yeah. And the result has been that you have all these new entrants into the affordable housing space who have historically focused on market rate housing. So
I that's so funny you say that. It's so true. I would be interested. Right. And I have so many good friends that are in the affordable game. And I always feel like it's just like you don't know. There's all this regulate. And it's literally people are trying to tell you, like, don't get involved, you know? And I don't know if it's to their benefit or anyone else's benefit, but it's like, I could probably figure it out, but I don't know if I want to. But that is like, yeah, could you imagine if we could get a finite timeline? It's like we think about all the time in tech, how to move faster to approval. Or like what you're doing specifically is like, here's a workflow. Increase the speed of workflow in order to get bodies into a unit faster. It's like, these are no-brainers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's really awesome. So listen, I always like to ask this question just like at the end so that we humanize it. So you're working your butt off. You got this incredible company that's expanding exponentially. What do you do to chill now? Like, what's your things that you do to just like relax when you're running the massive, like a really growth mode tech company and in New York?
What's that?
Yeah, exactly. Great answer.
Great answer. To be honest, I am definitely the type of person who, like, I'm quote unquote chilling before bed and I'm on LinkedIn looking up other companies. I love working. I love being part of the solution. I love growing Pronto, and there are other things in my life. I've got kids and dogs, but for the most part, I work my butt off.
So you might have been born in Palo Alto, but you're genetics were always of a New Yorker.
I think so. I think so.
All right. Thanks a million for coming on. We truly appreciate you. It was a really awesome subject.
Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. In conclusion, as we always say on Real Tech Talk, was it a medicine or a vitamin? And it is obvious if you've ever been in the space where you are developing either 421A, Affordable New York, or any development where there is an aspect of the municipality having to give affordability to units, it is a pain in the ass. The fact that you can take some technology now, a workflow, and make that more efficient, make that more easier, and now as a landlord or even as a consumer, knowing that the application is tight and crisp, we know that speeds up time. This is a medicine. I'm thinking that this company specifically runs the market one day, owns the American marketplace, and then that's where things get interesting, because pay attention to some of our AI episodes coming out. Those with the information on specific subject matter win. Real Tech Talk, baby. We're here, 45, and we'll be here for another 45. Peace.